If I asked you if you're living the good life, what would you say? Yes? Are you living the good life? Yeah? Here's the next question. How do you define that? Right, that's probably what your mind went first. What's he talking about? How's he defining the good life? How do you measure it? If you say yes, I would like you to be able to tell me at some point, here's why I am living the good life, or here's what the good life is. What if the answer to that question is no? I'm not giving the good life. I'm not living the good life. Which maybe it's even seasonal, right? Depends on when I ask you what's going on in your life. What if it's no? What would you do about it? How would you go about apprehending the good life? You know, there's another simple way to ask the question, are you living the good life, and how would you find the good life? And it's simply this. Are you following Jesus? Does that sound super spiritual? It's not super spiritual, really. It's intensely practical. We've essentially been looking at one chapter of the Bible for the better part of 3 months, Matthew chapter 5. We spent a lot of time in the Beatitudes. We spent the last 4 or 5 weeks in sort of the bulk of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is saying, you've been told this, I say this, here's what you ought to do. Better part of 3 months. I'm going to cover 2/3 of chapter 6 today. We're going to get through chapter 6 quick. But we have essentially been listening to Jesus tell us how to live the good life. And he points to people that are living the good life. So if you're living the good life, you're following Jesus. If you want to live the good life, you really need to follow Jesus. The beginning of chapter 5, the Beatitudes, is blessed are those, blessed are they. Is it just another way to say the good life belongs to, or the good life is? So if you're a Christian, you're a Jesus follower, and someone asks you, are you living the good life? You could just point to the beginning of Matthew chapter 5 and say yes, and here's what it looks like. But if you look at the beginning of Matthew chapter 5, after you just said you live the good life and it doesn't look like that, then what are you living? Or you look at it and you think, that's the good. Then that's what's going on. Jesus is saying, I want to help you live the good life. Just follow me. I'll walk you through it. When you start reading, though, you realize the good life isn't what we think it is, which is a sobering thought. When Jesus describes the good life, the reaction that most of us have or continue to have is, well, that doesn't seem right. That actually doesn't seem like the good life. Jesus is saying losing is better than winning. Did anybody of you have that in your definition of living the good life? You lost a bunch this week? Suffering and grief aren't something to be avoided. It's a virtue to suffer well. Did you have that in mind when I asked you if you were living the good life? You said, yeah, I'm losing and I'm suffering. Right? What life are we living? Jesus says, it's far better to have given away more than you've gotten. Was that in your definition? I'm living the good life because I have less than I used to. How about this one? He says that being at rest is better than having achieved something. When I asked you if you lived the good life, did any of you think, yeah, because I'm at rest, haven't accomplished much, but I'm resting? Right? It's funny. We laugh because it doesn't make sense to us. It's not what we think it is. He says, instead of being popular, it is way better to be at peace. There's something interesting about that one is we kind of resonate with that, right? We go, oof. What if someone said, you could be at peace, rather than be popular. A lot of us would be like, oof, I'll take that. And then tomorrow, work at getting popular. It's just weird. Like, we resonate with it. But it's not what instinctively happens in us. Not only is the good life not what we think it is, those whom Jesus pointed to and said, these are my all-stars. This is who I'm depending on to facilitate and perpetuate the good life, to put in place the kingdom that I inaugurate, and I'm inaugurating right now and on through history. These are the people that get it, are the shapers and the movers. They are people of limited means and capacity. Have you ever been in charge of hiring? The team that you're going to get together to accomplish the goal? Can you imagine if the first qualification is we're looking for people with limited means and very low capacity? That's who Jesus is looking for. He said the good life belongs to those who are poor in spirit. The good life belongs to those who are willing to face the grievous realities of life and feel what they are, not only in their own life, but in the world around them. Is there something to be grieved in your life today? Is there something to be grieved in the world around you today? Yes, yes. Are you grieving? Oftentimes, no. The one thing that humans seem to do extremely poorly, across the board, is grief. We just don't want to go there. Jesus says those who go there, who are living in reality of what's going on and burdened by it, this is who I'm looking for. He says, I'm looking for people that see wrong relationships in the world, relationships with God, with others, with their work. They see conflict. They see brokenness. And even when it's not their responsibility, my people step in there and help bring about peace, even if it costs them something. My people will help two people make amends, even if it costs them their relationship and their funds to make it happen. The good life is not what we think it is. In some cases, not even what I want. Right? Jesus says, I want to offer you the good life, and here's what it looks like. And in our deepest parts of us, we go, no thanks, actually. I want the good life, but that doesn't sound like a good life. Jesus, this is the good life. Now, what should be encouraging is when Jesus points to the people who he wants to be a part of this and who are a part of this, and we read that list and we think, well, that doesn't make sense. Limited means, I'm going to cast it, grievous, pressing, all these things, and I think, well, I actually have a shot there. When I look in the mirror, I start to see something a little more like what gets described there. And I'm just talking about how it feels. I think I've spent most of my life feeling like I'm not enough. Anybody on that boat? Anybody on that train? Yeah. I battle that all the time. It's right below the surface all the time. I don't obey it. I don't listen to it. But it messes me up. I don't feel like I'm enough. And Jesus says, you're the exact kind of person I'm looking for. Actually, not even just people that feel like they're not enough, people that aren't enough. They don't actually have much. He goes, I got so much I want to do through you. You actually get in the way if you think too much of yourself. There's some hope embedded in there. But boy, I tell you, are you living the good life? Let me ask you again. Let me read half of the Beatitudes. Actually, to be clear, the left half. I don't know if that makes sense, but it will in a minute. I'm going to read the left half of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted. This is an upside-down world Jesus is describing. This is the way the world is intended to operate and the kind of people that are intended to flourish in his world. It's up, down compared to what we think about when it comes to good life. It's upstream. It's not downstream. It's hard. It's hard. It requires intentionality to embrace it because it is not natural. We tend to come to Scripture, we come to Jesus, we come to God with a pretty strong and confident understanding of what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong, what is beautiful and what is ugly. We all have that. If I asked you those questions, what's good, what's bad, what's right, you have answers and you feel strongly about them. So strongly that oftentimes we come to Jesus, we come to Scripture, and we cherry pick. This lines up with what I think. That lines up with what I think. This lines up with what I think. This does not line up with it. Can't possibly be right that pain is okay, that pain could be good. I'm skipping that. We cherry pick. We think, what I think makes so much sense. I can argue for you why I think this is good and this is bad, why this is beautiful and this is ugly, why this is right and this is wrong. But Jesus is painfully clear that his ways are not our ways. So when you say, I want to follow Jesus, or you are following Jesus, one of the overriding senses should be, boy, this doesn't always feel right. Something feels a little off here from what I think. I think Jesus pretty clearly says it shouldn't make sense to you. In many cases, it is entirely different than how you've been raised, what you've been taught, the culture you live in. When I preach that, when he says the truth, it should at times not make sense because it doesn't fit into what we've determined to be. He says, you're going to have to live by faith. He says, you're going to have to trust me. And we think about faith and we think about trust in a lot of different ways, but this, the rubber meets the road right here. When you say, you're going to need to trust me. You're going to need to trust me that what you're thinking isn't quite right. That is not easy for people to do. Western sorts of people in particular, Western thought, does not lean into that space. Jesus said, you have to trust me. What I'm telling you, what I'm calling you to, who I'm saying that I want you to become, it's not going to resonate with you. You're going to have to trust me. You're going to have to put some faith in me. This is Proverbs 3:5. I bet most of you have read, maybe memorized this. I think it's the very first verse I ever memorized because my Sunday school teacher, Lynn Kochenauer, was beautiful, and I did whatever she asked me to do. When I was 9, she was like 18. She was like Amy Grant. She played the guitar, and she said, let's memorize this verse. I'm like, okay. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. What goes against every grain within us in most cases? Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and don't lean on your own understanding. Trust him and submit to him. Can you feel the angst of this? We just read Beatitudes and we just looked through the rest of chapter 5. It doesn't line up, and he's saying, yeah, I know, trust me and lean all the way in. Submit yourself to me. And this sort of thing is surely going on the mountainside as he's teaching. He's teaching, and I guarantee you, he's looking at the crowd, and every now and then someone goes, did he just say, I think so. Let's just listen. Oh, yeah, no, that's not good. And people would just leave. Every time Jesus spoke, people would leave. And not just the environment they're in. They would stop following him. Bunches. He was actually confused when they didn't. There's one time he's walking along, a large group of people are following him. He turns and goes, and essentially goes, hey, why are you all still following me? Are you not listening to me? Like he knew, he understood, if you listen to me, you're probably not going to follow me. So if there were too many people following him, he's like, I'm not making myself clear. Because what have they been hearing? They've been hearing that this life is to live upstream. But there are some people that are still pushing in, they're still leaning, they're still saying, we want to follow you. We want to do this. We want to take your words and we want to put them into action. And you would think that would be a wonderful time for Jesus to just be like, okay, thank you, this is wonderful. Thanks for sticking with me. I appreciate it. It means a lot to me. Let's get rolling. Instead, he goes, time out. I need to throw another warning at you. And that's what he's doing in chapter 6. He says, essentially, really what he's been saying in chapter 5 is this. It's not enough to behave. You look at the Beatitudes, you look at the sermon, there's a lot of things to do and a lot of things to not do. And he's saying, but that's not what's going on here. It is not enough to behave. Let that sink in for a minute. Here's everything you should do. Here's everything you should not do. Your life is, maybe it's a wreck. Maybe you're looking, this is, maybe Jesus is your last chance. And he says, here's the playbook. And you're thinking, finally, someone's told me what to do and I've got a thing to do. And he goes, yeah, but it's not about behavior. He says, you're accountable not only for your behavior, but for the attitudes and thoughts and impulses that are in your heart. That's a tough pill to swallow. And the most superficial and maybe a far too common definition of Christianity is that we don't behave poorly and we don't let any bad things that are in our heart come out in our behavior. How many of you thought that was the definition of Christianity, other than the salvation piece with Jesus, right? He died for you. It's the only pathway, for sure. Trust him for that. Forgiveness, redemption, divine approval. When it gets to living this life, we tend to think Christianity is about doing all the good things, not doing all the bad things. And anything that comes up in my heart that's negative or wants me to do something bad, it's my Christian duty to bury that and to not let that come out. And Jesus says, that isn't Christianity really at all. He's like, Moses, that was Moses for sure. You don't need me. Jesus could say, you don't need me if you think Christianity is about obedience. You already have all those rules. He's, I've come to fill it up. I've come to complete it. What does he mean by that? Live it out perfectly? Yeah, but more than that. Not just live it out perfectly, but live it out wholly, fully. I came to complete it. I came to be the one who not only does the right stuff, doesn't do the bad stuff, but it comes out of my heart, which wants to do the right stuff and not the bad stuff in my heart. I fill it up. What's in my heart is in my behavior. What's in my behavior is what's my heart. He's filling it up. So I want you to do the same. I want your internal world of reality, your attitudes, your actions, your impulses to actually be in alignment with God, your heart. I am not looking for your behavior to mirror the behavior and the character of God. I want your heart to be like his heart. I want your heart to be like my heart. It is not enough to behave. In fact, he would say those internal, catch this, those internal attitudes and impulses in your life, the ones you don't let come out because you're a good Christian, those attitudes and those impulses are a better reflection of who you are than your behavior in God's eyes. He's judging you by what's in your heart, not what you're doing. You are what's at the core of you. And he doesn't want to leave you there. He isn't going to say, as long as you behave and the world all gets along better, we're good. Jesus is saying, no, that is not good. What is good is when it's in the heart, when you've been formed and transformed, and at the core of who you are, you're like Jesus. He said in Matthew chapter 5, 48, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. And this kind of pushes us down our path of behavior. Because when you and I think about perfect, what do we think about? We think about behavior. This word perfect If you kind of just pull it out of itself more fully, it would go like this. Therefore, become whole and complete. It's that kind of perfect. Be whole and complete as your heavenly Father is whole and complete. Be aligned and symmetrical in your heart and your mind. Jesus said, love the Lord your God in everything that you do, and that's good. No, he didn't say that at all. He said, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind. I want you to be perfect. I want you to move in the direction of wholeness and completeness. And right here in chapter 6, he throws this warning out. It's going to be very difficult not to turn my teachings into a set of behaviors through which you'll try to find the good life. You'll try to take these good things that I'm telling you, and you'll try to find the good life by doing them. You're going to try to find the good life by taking what I'm teaching you and try to win the approval of others with it. You're going to try to get God's information from what I'm teaching you. And he's saying, but you're not looking deeply enough into what I'm teaching you. Let me warn you. That dynamic will derail your formation. It'll derail your wholeness. It'll derail the good life you long for. When you fall into this performance to find significance trap, when you fall into this performance to find the good life, it actually derails your pathway, the train to the good life. There's more that needs to happen. I should probably tell you that while I was on my summer break, I spent a week in Costa Mesa, California. It was pretty rough. Could walk to the beach. We did it once. I was at a conference / retreat for 28 I guess you could say senior level leaders. They're looking for people that have been leading in the primary position, whether business or nonprofit or church, that need some help. Their leadership is faltering in some way, or there's challenges you've not been able to get over, and they invite 28 at a time. They do it 3 or 4 times a year in different parts of the country, and it's a lie. The whole thing is set up. It's a bait and switch. But I knew about it, so I knew it was coming. But what they do there is it's called ultimate leadership, right? So leaders are flocking to it. Oh, man, I want to be an ultimate leader. But what's going on, their secret sauce is for you to be a good leader, you need to look at what's going on inside of you. And we spent an hour and a half, 3 times a day, in a 7-person counseling group therapy space. I actually loved it. I loved it. And I could tell you more, but I'll say this. It actually changed my life. And the first proof is things that are alive in me that haven't been for a while. And the second proof is, well, talk to Tammy. What it's done for our ability to connect and relate. I was so overdue. And it struck me while I was there that we have been talking about wholeness in this church a lot, intensely over the last 13 weeks. And I'm so grateful for the teaching team that we have. Y'all know we meet every week and talk through the messages that we bring to y'all. And I am so grateful for the way they've taught while I've been on break, the wisdom that they brought to bear and bring to bear in my life regularly. The preparatory work of wholeness set me up beautifully for God to do some wholeness work in me. And I actually didn't think it was possible. I live a pretty good life, and I thought, it's good enough. And some of the things that I long for, some of the things that I wish were alive, I thought, well, they'll be alive one day. I might not get it this side of heaven. And some of that's true. But I was overjoyed to realize that God's got some stuff he's still willing to do with me and bring me into greater wholeness. So thank you for your prayers, your support as I've been on this little break. It's been nourishing to my heart in some ways I can barely describe. I just thought I should tell you that. So Jesus is firing the performance significance warning flare. So let's read it, right? Let's read a little bit of Matthew chapter 6. I'm going to skip around a little bit because some of it is, there are different messages. But I want you to hear some themes here. He starts right here. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. Wow. Should I read that again? Be careful not to practice your righteousness. Be careful not to practice your good works. Be careful not to practice the things that God has called you to in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father. That's a pretty heavy warning. So when you give to the needy, don't announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. They got everything they're going to get. Skip to 6:4. So that your giving may be in secret, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you go, when you pray, go into your room, close the door. Pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees, pray to the one who is unseen. And when he sees you in secret, he'll reward you. Skip into 6:16. When you fast, don't look somber as the hypocrites do. They disfigure their faces to show others that they're fasting. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head, which means clean yourself, take a shower. Clean yourself up. Make it look like you're not fasting, for crying out loud. Wash your face so it's not obvious that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So what's the central insight here? I've alluded to it. Maybe I've said it. If you're living a life of identity by applause, if you're living a life of identity by applause, if you're living your life in order to feel good about yourself, to feel like you're enough, to feel like you're valuable, to feel like you've got a shot, if the way to that sense of being is to get the applause of others, you're splitting yourself apart. The longing you have to feel enough and complete and with anxiety is a actually very godly place to be. It's a true place to be. We don't feel like enough. True? Let it be known to God. We don't feel complete. We feel like two people or three people, depending on who's in the room. Anxiety is on the move. But if you're living a life through this identity by applause, the things that you long to be remedied in your soul cannot be. This is the warning that Jesus is firing. Your ability to get approval and applause and kudos and trophies and status with your good performance will rip your heart out, and it will tear you down. And if all the while your heart isn't good. When your heart is aligned with your purposes, there's wholeness and there's formation. When it's not, there's anti-formation. It tears you apart. Everybody knows you as a gracious and kind person, but internally, you're constantly judging people, and there are a few of them you would like genuinely like to slap. You're known as incredibly generous. You always pick up the check. You give, you help. But inside, you resent when people expect you to do that. You're known as calm and patient. You never lose your temper, but underneath you're furious. You've just gotten really good at making it seem otherwise. That kind of living and a million other examples is tearing you apart. You will be getting a little jazz from the applause. Like, that feels good. But the hypocrisy will be breaking you. And Jesus says, I want so much more for you. So much more for your heart. Paul teaches it this way. He says, am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Am I trying to please people? The gains and the applause and the stuff we get from people, it's something, but it's like an inch deep. The longer you live, the more you realize that's true. It's only an inch deep. Leaves you wanting. You got to come back for more. It never lasts. Jesus says, my reward smashes that. It's thousands of yards deep. And then he tells us how to break this life-sucking performance to significance cycle, but we'll come to that in just a little bit. I want to pull out three things in Matthew chapter 6 in 3 minutes. Hypocrisy. What's the modern definition of hypocrisy? It's pretending to be something that you're not, right? You aren't who you appear to be. We've been talking about that. The core of the word hypocrisy is actor. Did you know that? Actor. A hypocrite is an actor. But Jesus is identifying even something deeper than just the acting. This is the reality with an actor. They never intend to become the character. And in life, hypocrisy is acting. And what's beneath it is, I don't actually ever intend to be what I am on the outside. That's what Jesus is warning about. An actor never intends to become the character. And he's saying, I want you to become these good things through and through. That's what makes Jesus' choice of the word hypocrite so brilliant. He is warning people of the danger of being opposed to actual change and formation. Go back to the beginning of the message. I said, when you look at the Beatitudes and you see the descriptions of what the good life is, what we need to posture, we need to take is not to take the position of an actor like, oh, I guess I can do all these things even though I don't feel like these things and I am not these things. He's saying, no, the idea is be willing to change. Be willing to change. See it and go, I'm not going to lean on my own understanding. I'm going to trust Jesus in order to gain an award, much reward much deeper than what I can get on my own. He's saying, trust me on this. When you live out of alignment, mind, heart, intellect, heart, however you want to put it, you become somebody to the masses, but you become nobody in the mirror. You do become somebody to the masses. They have an impression of you. You've won their approval. You've persuaded them. But when you look in the mirror, and you know this feeling, you see a fraud, and it's tearing you apart. Hypocrisy starves the formation process, and it actually feeds fragmentation. I'll go back to these examples. Everybody knows you as a gracious and kind person, but internally you're constantly judging people. And that dissonance, that misalignment, that hypocrisy makes you more angry or lustful or cheating or lying or vindictive or a promise breaker or evasive. All the things that Jesus is teaching that he wants us to be breaking the sinful habits of, those things actually become more prominent when your head and your heart aren't aligned. When formation isn't happening, you become more of those things. And now you're trying to press even more of it down and it just the wheels come off. Look, you cannot just push down all this reality and try to do these behaviors. It'll rip you apart. You've got to open this up, be honest about what's going on, and let me form you. The hypocrisy is killing you and making it worse and worse and worse. So where are we? Don't be an actor. Make formation of heart the greatest objective. Behavior's great. Please come in here and behave. It's just better for everybody. But don't make that your priority. Your priority is formation. Let's follow Jesus in the pathway of being formed. We have 1 second left to do the last two. Let me see how I can do this. Or John, do you want to just pick up right here next week? John's coming up next week. He's shaking his head yes. How about Pastor John? He's like, yeah, I can finish this off in just a few minutes. It's probably what he's thinking. Could have done this whole message. We'd be on our way to lunch right now if I was preaching. That's what he's thinking. So we need to talk a little bit about rewards. Let me just give you some of the final statements on these things, and we'll just call it a day. Because you've got enough already, right? Have we not? I think we got plenty. I do. what was I going to say here at the end of this little thing? Let me find it. It kind of goes like this. We start to believe that this, the rewards of this world, is all that there really is. We have a trust issue here too, that the rewards that God wants to provide won't actually do it to the level of what I can do on my own. Are you with me? We don't really think, or maybe we've tried it and his rewards, they just don't really get me going, like the rewards I can earn on my own. There's this lie that this is all there is. The truth of the matter, that's the lie. This is all there is. These rewards are better. God's not going to give you any rewards that, I'll take the jazz, right? Your soul is hungering for something greater. And the proof of that is the fracturing. Your soul is hungering for something greater. You continue to pursue the sugar and the quick fixes, and the fractures are actually getting worse. Bunch of verses, Jeremiah. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, a quenching deep reward. They've dug their own cisterns. They're broken, they can't hold water. Isaiah says, why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Hosea, speaking for God, when I fed them, they were satisfied. And they were satisfied. Then they became proud, they started to seek their own rewards, and they forgot me. Fractures are really the evidence that you were made for more than the life you're trying to convince yourself is enough. Fractures may also, think about fractures, this the anger, lust, lying, the things that Jesus talks about, see those as an evidence that you were actually made for more. Let them be the thing that shows you that these rewards that I'm pursuing are not working. The things that you see in your life, oh, it's not Christian. I should push it down. I want this to get out. No, you got to go, whoa, this is telling me that these rewards are not going to work. I need to move toward God in some way. Don't act. Prioritize formation. Admit that this world's rewards aren't enough. Trust God to reward you deeply. The final go is secrecy, right? He says, basically says this, go where the audience cannot reward you. Go where the audience cannot reward you. This is the first commandment. We've talked about this ad nauseum. The first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before you, better rendered is, you are to have no other gods in between your face and my face. Be with me. Listen to Paul. Be approved of by God. Do your stuff. Do your calling. Do your work. And let God see it. And actually do your level best to not let anybody else see it. One of the best advices I got 20 years ago in my leadership journey was always be doing something really hard in secret. It's a difficult exercise. It lets you realize how much you depend on others' approval to keep going. The point here is, take a step of faith here and begin to discover that God's voice is enough and provides something deeper than what anybody else can provide. And here's one of the other keys. You cannot have both. do it in secret. Let your good works, let your calling, let your ministry, let your job, let your life, let it be known as best you can by God alone and see what happens. The application of secrecy functions like spiritual strength training. It starves ego validation and it sensitizes your soul to God's approval. Don't be an actor. Prioritize formation. Devalue worldly rewards. Do hard things in secret. Believe that being seen by God can be enough. Oh, that's all. Amen.